At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president tried pretty hard in his speech last night to change the subject off Iraq and Afghanistan and onto the economy. We'll have a conversation on the political economy of war coming up. Also, Wall Street just loves September so far. And we will take your mobile phone on the road. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to September, everybody. It is Wednesday the 1st, and it is good to have you here. In Baghdad this morning, Vice President Joe Biden and Defense Secretary Robert Gates took up where the president left off in his speech last night. The new era in Iraq has officially started. Operation New Dawn began with a ceremony in one of Saddam Hussein's old palaces today. 7.5 years and, by most estimates, something between $1 and $3 trillion later, the news of the day provides an opportunity to take stock, to try to figure out what the United States got for its money. Andrew Bacevich teaches international relations at Boston University. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the program.
Is there a way for us to figure out how much this war in Iraq and also in Afghanistan has cost us?
You know, I think we'll never know. And we'll never know because the people in Washington don't want us to know. If indeed we could tally up the actual dollar costs, I think they would end up being so large that there would be a great hue and cry from the people. That will be one of those numbers that I think will tend to be very elusive.
We can't figure out then in pure bottom line terms return on investment, right? I mean, we had a set of goals, but we don't know how much we spent, and so we're at sea a little bit.
Well, it's worse than that because the goals, of course, shifted over time. I mean, in the immediate wake of the fall of Baghdad, we were told that the goals included the transformation of Iraq into a liberal democracy in which the rights of Iraqi women would be protected in perpetuity. More than 7 years later, we're certainly settling for quite a bit less. So the longer the war lasted, the more it cost, and in a sense, the lower the objectives came to be. The unwillingness to demand anything like strict accountability has become a deeply ingrained habit in Washington, D.C., and it's a habit that neither Democrats nor Republicans are willing to challenge.
What about the people in the United States, though? Because we are finally attuned domestically to how much money we have spent on the TARP, on how much money we have spent on the bailout, and yet it does not translate, it seems, that curiosity into foreign policy.
It doesn't, because in terms of the average American, the number is a theoretical one that doesn't have any direct personal immediate impact. If indeed we've spent roughly $1 trillion on the Iraq war alone, that hasn't resulted in me or you paying higher taxes. So this enormous expenditure of money hasn't affected you and me directly. It will end up affecting your children, my grandchildren. I expect that future generations will probably curse us for our unwillingness to pay for wars that were undertaken in our name.
We've been talking about the Iraq War. The general press buzz the past couple of days has been, ooh, combat operations are over. And now what we have is this advise and assist mission over there. But that does not close the financial books. I mean, we're still spending huge amounts of money over there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is we have combat brigades still in Iraq. We've just attached a different label to those combat brigades, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that we'll be able to keep them out of further combat. But we'll continue to spend billions in Iraq. And as others have pointed out, we'll continue to spend hundreds of billions in residual costs, if you will, from the Iraq War, to recapitalize the Army and the Marine Corps in particular, to pay the costs of veterans' benefits. So if we would say at this point that the Iraq War has cost us roughly $1 trillion, we're best off saying that's $1 trillion and counting.
Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His new book is called Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Dr. Bacevich, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Here comes one of those awkward segues you got to make every now and then. Wars and deficits and thoughts of pretty much anything unpleasant were far from top of mind on Wall Street today. All three major indices were off to the races right from the opening bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's some kind of sad irony to be had in this next story, or maybe it's more a case of whether we'll ever learn from our mistakes. The number of foreclosed homes has been growing, as you know. Not far behind, though, are professional investors buying those homes and flipping them. That's been making it tough for communities to do their own housing initiatives to make things right again. So now HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, is launching a new program. It'll guarantee local governments and nonprofits a better chance at buying those distressed properties. Bank of America and Wells Fargo, no strangers to foreclosures themselves, have signed off on the deal as well. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Under the First Look program, banks will give local governments and nonprofits first dibs on buying foreclosed properties. Sarah Greenberg is with NeighborWorks America, a nonprofit housing group.
The foreclosure crisis has created a lot of vacant properties that are piling up in communities, dragging down property values, and having a negative impact on the surrounding neighborhood.
The federal government has pledged about $7 billion to the effort. More than 100,000 homes could be sold in some of the country's hardest-hit areas. Many of those areas have become playgrounds for speculators. The National Association for Realtors found investors accounted for about a fifth of all home sales in July. But Greenberg says private investment won't be enough to turn these neighborhoods around.
Many times an investor is looking for a quick investment opportunity. So they may purchase the property and do some very minimal improvements, but they won't necessarily bring it up to code or to the standard of the neighborhood.
Greenberg says nonprofits and local governments will make new properties energy efficient and will subsidize lower-income families into homes. Those types of investments can strengthen a neighborhood, says Adam Weiner with online realtor Redfin.
So it becomes a much more sort of consistent and stable, predictable model for home prices.
So what's in it for the banks, who may be selling to a lower bidder? UCLA real estate professor Stuart Gabriel says they're getting something out of it, too.
Oftentimes, sales fall out of contracts. And in this particular case, you would have contracts constructed at likely very near market prices by reliable borrowers.
Gabriel says it's likely banks own other mortgages in the area, so they'll be happy to see prices stabilize. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If I could fake a yawn here really well, I'd tell you about the Apple news today. CEO Steve Jobs made his usual jeans and black turtleneck appearance at an event in San Francisco. Updated iPods, new versions of iTunes, Apple TV as well, 99 cents for TV shows, $4.99 for first-run movies, which is nice and all. But let me ask you this. Doesn't it seem like there's a big Apple event like every 3 weeks or something? Anyway, let me take you now to Pavilion, Wyoming, population 150. It's a farming town. out in the middle of the prairie, a couple of hundred miles from Yellowstone National Park. The EPA has just given the good people of Pavilion some bad news. The feds have found methane and other yucky stuff in local wells. They're trying to figure out whether some nearby drilling for natural gas might be the culprit. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Wyoming is one of more than 30 states abundant in natural gas. It's also where the EPA just found benzene, a carcinogen, and the natural gas methane in local water wells. Pavilion, Wyoming hay farmer John Fenton attended a local EPA meeting yesterday. He says regulators gave this advice.
We are to find an alternate source of drinking and cooking water.
And residents should be
ventilating the bathrooms, the laundry room, anywhere that where methane could collect and might create an explosion problem.
Fenton says his water well was doing just fine till it started bubbling and smelling like propane last year. Similar tales have popped up around the country, often near drilling sites. The type of drilling, called fracking, shoots water, sand, and chemicals deep into the earth. But so far, the EPA says it doesn't know if fracking has caused the water problems and is still investigating. For its part, industry says rules require wells to be lined with cement. John Robitaille at the Petroleum Association of Wyoming says the aim is to prevent leakage.
There are safeguards in place that do not allow for that type of thing to happen when we drill an oil and gas well.
Still, it's a heated fight over a kind of drilling considered a game changer in the energy sector. State and federal regulators could make it tougher to issue new drilling permits. Analyst Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners says authorities in the Delaware River Basin will soon issue their restrictions.
But it's going to stagger a lot of investors. It's going to be very restrictive, governing shale gas production in that watershed. Meanwhile, the federal government is watching from not very far away.
In the congressional hopper is a bill requiring oil and gas companies to disclose the chemicals they shoot underground. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The soon-to-be former head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors gave a farewell speech this morning. Christina Romer leaves Friday to go back to Berkeley. Today, though, she said some pretty bold things about not worrying about deficits if you want to lower the unemployment rate, things that are generally easier to say if you're on the way out. In or out, commentator David Frum is not buying any of it.
The administration's promise of a summer of recovery was delusional. Yes, some recovery can be glimpsed in the economic statistics. But an unemployed person's odds of finding work are barely better than when the Obama stimulus plan was adopted. Supposedly, the recession ended last summer. Yet the percentage of adult Americans at work is lower now than it was 6 months ago. Businesses continue to shed jobs faster than they create them. The risk that employment will decline further as the Obama administration's fiscal stimulus ends is very real. Consumers are not spending because they feel poor and getting poorer. They borrowed a lot of money in the 1990s and 2000s. Their equity in their homes has shrunk or disappeared. These wretched figures should force us to rethink old assumptions. Each party's anti-recession ideas have been tested and have failed. The recession began when all the Bush tax cuts were fully in effect, and yet it suggested that reenacting the tax cuts will somehow cure the crisis that those same tax cuts failed to prevent. Meanwhile, job losses have continued all the time the Obama economic remedies were working through the system. The Obama fiscal stimulus added $800 billion to the debt, and still we have not scraped ourselves off the floor. The 2007-2008 economic collapse was a really, really big calamity. Yet we have not taken that calamity's big lessons. Yes, we've tightened bank regulation a little. It will be tougher in future for banks to bet 30 times their capital that uncreditworthy borrowers will somehow find the money to repay huge loans. But the idea that homeownership is for everybody, that capital gains from housing will compensate ordinary Americans for stagnant wages, that we can raise living standards while importing 1 million low-wage workers every year, on those fundamentals, Albert Einstein's old lament still holds. Everything has changed except our thinking.
Commentator and former Bush administration speechwriter David Frum is the editor nowadays of Frum Forum. Back next week in this space course, Robert Reich. We would love to hear your thoughts. Send them to us at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says content. Coming up, taking a vacation? You know, there's an app for that.
I can hold up my phone just as if I'm taking a picture, and it will tell me which points of interest are within a surrounding vicinity.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh my, September is off to a sizzling start. The Dow Industrials charged up 254 points today, about 2.5%, closed at 10,269. The NASDAQ piled on 62 points, 2.9%, finished at 2176. The NASDAQ did. The S&P 500 packed on 30 points, also 2.9%, ended things at 1,080. Good news on manufacturing helped fuel that rally. Bank of America surged 6%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited more than 3.75%. Rising crude prices for oil pushed up energy stocks. Chevron jumped more than 3.5%. ExxonMobil dashed up more than 3% today. Apple moved up nearly 3% on that announcement that I kind of yawned over. GE lit up on news that it may spend $30 billion on acquisitions in the next couple of years. Shares up 3.75% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Did the hot weather drive consumers to the mall, keep them home? Chain stores report sales figures for the month of August. Another look at what's going on in the housing market. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for July. And a happy anniversary shout out to the U.S. Treasury Department. It's been managing government finances for 221 years. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As David Frum was reminding us just a couple of moments ago, consumers are feeling fairly cash poor these days. Political candidates, money to burn, at least when it comes to television ads for the upcoming midterm elections. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on why this is shaping up to be yet another record year for campaign spending.
Candidates have already spent over $800 million on TV ads this year, and that's $50 million more than the record pace set in the 2008 presidential election. One reason is the large number of competitive races.
It's really almost like an arms race at this point.
Evan Tracy tracks campaign ad spending at Campaign Media Analysis Group. He says the Obama administration's agenda has attracted some enthusiastic, well-heeled support and opposition.
Between health care and financial reform and even potential legislation like cap and trade and card check, that's certainly gotten business more motivated to fund candidates that are going to come to Washington and, if not repeal some of this legislation, at least try and pull it back some.
And businesses are taking advantage of fewer limits on campaign ad spending. The Supreme Court earlier this year lifted those caps, and Jed Lewison with the Daily Coast blog says the court also relaxed disclosure requirements.
Any group that didn't want to have its name attached to an ad now can put an ad out there under a different name. That frees up a certain amount of money.
Add to that the fact that states will redraw the lines for congressional and state legislative districts next year. Each party wants its governor to oversee the redistricting process. What you end up with, according to one longtime tracker of campaign money, is a perfect storm for fundraising, even in a down economy. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today's rally in equities, and quite a rally it was, took a bit of the edge off gold. The shiny yellow stuff faded just a tad after getting to within $10 of its all-time high, almost $1,250 an ounce on the close in New York. Depending on who you listen to, like this guy you're about to hear, even at this price, gold is a screaming buy.
I'm Gordon Liddy, and I want to share with you something that will protect your future in a very solid, very real way. Gold. It's never too late to secure your future with gold. Gold is an intrinsically valuable, liquid preserver of purchasing power that has held value for over 5,000 years. In these tough times, that's more important than ever.
Yes, that was G. Gordon Liddy, the Watergate guy. David Moon runs Moon Capital Management in Knoxville, Tennessee. He is not quite as big a fan of gold at $1,200 an ounce as Mr. Liddy is. David, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Kai.
So last year about this time, when gold was, you know, touching on $1,200 an ounce, it was all, ooh, gold bubble, it's going to crash soon, it's going to crash. And then I read the other day there are analysts saying it's going to go to $1,500 an ounce. Whatever happened to the bubble talk?
Well, I was one of the people that was involved in the bubble talk, and I have been wrong about gold for so long. I no longer have any respect for my own opinion, Kai.
let me start maybe then by asking you, why is gold different? I mean, it's all the, you know, the safe haven talk, and in times of trouble that's where people go. But I mean, gold doesn't do anything; it just sits there.
You're exactly right. It was Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, who says that you take gold, you take it out of the ground in Africa. You put it on a boat, you ship it to the United States, and you put it back into the ground in Kentucky. 95% of the gold that's ever been mined since the inception of humankind is still in existence. It's still out there. It hasn't been used for anything. Unlike silver or platinum or weapons-grade uranium, those are things that once they're brought into existence, they're consumed. Oil gets consumed. The only thing that causes the price of gold to go up these days is fear or greed. It's the same thing that caused internet stocks to become overpriced in 98 and 99.
Why do we pay attention to it then?
When we become anxious, our anxiety gets focused on things. The other reason we pay attention to it is because marketing works. When Glenn Beck and Gordon Liddy are on television every day, but if they were advertising timber, which is a much better natural resource, timber prices would be higher. At least in the short term.
Are there real macroeconomic reasons for gold being higher? I mean, interest rates are at zero. You know, you plow it into bonds and it goes nowhere. I mean, does gold make you any money?
It only makes money as long as people move their money into gold. There are micro reasons that gold prices can go up, and that's what you've identified. And that is that as long as the Federal Reserve keeps the risk-free rate of interest at zero, then money is going to move into all sorts of risky asset classes, including gold.
Are you buying this $1,500 an ounce figure we're seeing?
You know what? I don't have a target for gold. There's no way to predict when bubbles will pop. It's the reason that short selling any asset is dangerous, because an overvalued asset can stay overvalued for a long, long time. Could it go to $1,500? Absolutely. Could it stay at $1,200 for a long time? Absolutely. Keep in mind that even though the U.S. government fixed gold prices at around $18.50 through most of the 1800s, the world price of gold spiked around 1860, and it took 110 years for the price to recover to that point. Whether or not you make money in gold as much as anything else depends on the price that you pay for it.
Are people ever going to get over it? I mean, it's historically ingrained, right, that we want gold just because it's gold.
There are several things that are culturally, historically ingrained in us that we want, and most of those are ingrained for emotional reasons, and none of them are very healthy. And I'll leave it at that.
David Moon, he's the president of Moon Capital Management in Knoxville, Tennessee, talking about gold. Mr. Moon, thanks so much for your time.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
As you think back on your summer vacation, how many of you spent time flipping through guidebooks, trying to figure out what was worth spending time doing and what you could safely take a pass on? A lot of you, probably. And for you, there is a growing industry trying to turn your smartphone into a 21st century tour guide. Sometimes it works out, and as Joel Rose reports now from Philadelphia, sometimes it doesn't.
One mobile app company is treating tourism like a game. The first rule?
If it isn't fun, don't do it. And we take that very, very seriously.
That's Seth Prebatch, the founder of Scavenger. It's a game you play on your mobile phone. Scavenger tells you where to go, and when you get there, it gives you a challenge, like solving a riddle or snapping a picture of a local landmark.
If you do enough challenges, you'll earn points and you'll unlock rewards, which are things like free coffee, half off your ice cream, you know, free appetizers at your favorite restaurant, you name it.
To see how it works, I decided to try a scavenger challenge here in Philadelphia. So I'm standing here near the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the very famous statue of Rocky, and let's see what the phone wants me to do. The challenge is show us your mitts for 2 points. Give us your best fighter pose and have a friend take your picture. All right, here we go. Can I just get you to take my picture in front
sure,
of the statue?
Of course.
Thank you.
Here you go.
The challenges in Scavenger are suggested by its partners, in this case, the local tourism office. But at least there's a human editor, someone who's deciding what's worthwhile and what isn't. Seth Prebatch wants to make sure Scavenger is more than just a bunch of corporate marketers run amok.
Scavenger actually turns down probably in the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars a month from brands, from potential partners who want to do things that don't strike us as fun.
This is a serious concern. A lot of free tourism websites turn out to be little more than ads for chain hotels and restaurants. And Scavenger isn't the only company trying to provide a better experience when it comes to your smartphone.
So if I'm in San Francisco, I can hold up my phone just as if I'm taking a picture, and it will tell me which points of interest are in that direction that you're looking and within a surrounding vicinity.
John Boris is a vice president at Lonely Planet, which is famous for its print guides. The company now offers mobile applications, charging $5 and up per city for the same independent reviews of local attractions.
You do get what you pay for. If you are going to a city, if you are making a big investment for a trip, we do view this as a relatively nominal investment to ensure that you have the best possible trip.
But the professional travel writers may soon have to contend with competition from, well, everyone else. Last month, Facebook announced that its 500 million users can now post their locations using its Places service.
That Facebook announcement meant that location has now gone mass market.
Susan Ettlinger is a consultant with Altimeter Group in Silicon Valley. She says it won't be long before our smartphones can show us location-specific recommendations from the people in our social networks.
If I'm in Chicago and I want deep dish pizza, here's the place that all my friends have gone to. And then you can start to get those recommendations from your friends, and they're free, as opposed to having to pay for it through another service.
Of course, that only works if you trust your friends to make sure you have the best possible trip. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a warm welcome to Dan Akerson. If you have never heard of Mr. Akerson, you will. He is the new CEO of the car company that American taxpayers own. Today was his first day on the job at General Motors. Not coincidentally, it's worth a mention that we learned this morning that GM sales last month were lousy, down 7% from a month earlier. Ford was off too. Chrysler was the lucky winner, up 7%. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow charged up 254 points, 2.5%. The NASDAQ piled on 62 points, 2.9%. The S&P 500 racked up 30 points, also 2.9%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this particular radio broadcast, recession plus policy equals a $1 trillion shortfall.
States have a tendency to set benefit levels, know that it is a future cost, and decide to worry about it tomorrow.
Pension benefits, that is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.